This week on the BOAG World Show, we ask a single, very important question. How do we keep that client work coming in? This week's show is sponsored by Videoblocks and Vivaldi. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me on this week's show is Andy Clark, Drew McClellan, Sam Barnes and Marcus Lillington. Hello all.
Hello. Hey.
Hello, Paul.
We got pretty close to just not bothering with this show this week, didn't we?
Yeah, because I'm not meant to be here. I'm on holiday, Paul. That's how much I like the show and you.
It's nothing to do with like. You just see
it. Basically, no, actually, Paul, that's what it is.
The only reason you're here doing the show is because basically this podcast is your only vague effort at marketing.
Oh, it takes the knife from his heart.
Tell me that basically this is it as far as marketing is concerned. I've no idea how Headscape has survived as long as it has with you.
Actually, that's quite interesting because that kind of partly covers what I'm going to talk about today, if we get to me.
Ooh.
There is a connection.
Because we're talking about the cliff, isn't it?
Yes.
You're always 3 months away from oblivion when you run an agency.
Yeah.
Well, this has got off to a cheery start.
Yeah. I do some other things, Paul, but this is definitely the lion's share of my marketing effort.
An hour a week when you can be asked.
Whilst on holiday, I might add.
Whilst on holiday. Yeah. Come. Yeah. Thanks, Sam.
No problem.
Don't stick up for him. Nobody does that. This goes against the premise of the show. So Marcus nearly didn't turn up because he's on holiday and can't be asked. I seem to be unable to get into the room room as in the virtual room where we do this. And Drew is rapidly having to delete files off of his computer so he's got enough space to record this.
It's like when there's a forest fire. You know how they sort of scuttle ahead of it trying to clear space to stop the fire spreading. That's kind of what I'm doing here. I think I'm okay.
I'm very pleased you've just described our podcast as a forest fire.
Not nearly as successful, Paul. Not nearly as successful as a forest fire.
But does cause devastation in its wake.
Absolutely.
I've got a bag of licorice if anybody can't
understand. Oh, yeah. I forgot that bit. I forgot Andy nearly became unable to join us on the show because he stuck his teeth together with licorice.
But it's still not finished, so if you can't understand what I'm saying, then that'll be because of it.
He'll have to put his spare set in.
He must be of that age,
must
he?
Be, yeah. Was it 60 yesterday, Andy?
It was 51, thank you, cheeky bastard.
So yes, happy birthday for yesterday.
Thank you.
So Andy would have been in the school year above me, and he would have been one of the bully boys.
Oh, he must have been a bully, surely.
I would have slapped you in the head.
Yeah, I bet you were really horrible at school. I bet he wasn't. Yeah, you would have been.
No, I was a bit Wendy at school, really, to be honest.
Were you really? Mm. Honestly?
Yeah. I don't think I ever... I never really got into any trouble at all, ever.
Right. Were you kind of a bit of a geeky, nerdy kid? Or I bet you played things like football and stuff like that.
No, God, no. No. I hated sport. Completely. In fact, when in the fourth year, when I must have been, about 14 or something, I actually fell over and injured my neck and I had to go to an osteopath. And the osteopath basically gave me this note to say, Andy can't do sports until his neck's better. Yeah. And I kept that note and kept photocopying it and getting my mum to sign it for the next 5 years or so. So I never actually ever play rugby or football.
My trick was I used to have really bad hay fever. So what I used to do is I used to sneak out at break time just before PE, rub my hands in the grass and then rub my hands on my face to the point that my eyes would swell shut in order to get me out of PE.
Tricky in the winter though, Paul.
Yeah, and it didn't work so much
in the winter.
It
made you muddy.
which was worse because, of course, in the winter, that's when the ground is rock hard and they make you play rugby. And so I remember very vividly with rugby, because I would basically stand as far away from the ball as physically possible, you know, and avoid it at all cost. And there was one game of rugby where for some reason I looked up and this ball descended towards me and I accidentally caught it, which was entirely an accident. And then I looked round and I saw just, you know, a wall of aggressive looking boys running towards me. So I ran away from them as fast as I possibly could. And then eventually one of them caught up with me and tackled me to the ground. At which point I scored a try because I happened to be standing in the right place when he managed to catch me and tackle me to the ground. And that's the only time I've ever scored a goal, a try or anything.
Hang
like
on
that.
A minute. This sounds a bit like Forrest Gump.
No, I swear to you.
What was your nickname at school?
Was it Forrest Gump? Forrest Gump wasn't out at that point. And I swear to you that that is the truth. I forgot that it happened in Forrest Gump, actually.
I'm quite impressed, Paul, that you scored a try. Full yeah. stop.
That's pretty good. It was only because it was pure luck. So there you go.
No, but you would have had to have got past or through the marauding boys to have scored a try. The only way you could have actually run away from them is back over, you know, behind you where... Back to your try.
Perhaps I scored a try for the wrong side.
Well, I was so paying so much attention in a game of school rugby once that I didn't realise that we changed sides at half time.
I've done that, yeah.
And then I tackled somebody who was running towards me and he was on my team.
That's quite good. I quite like that one.
That's a bit shit.
Now I'm worried about my story. I'm worried that actually I'm just remembering the plot of Forrest Gump. Because you've got a point there, Marcus. Why I ran away from the boys. So how did that work?
Well, unless they'd all been clumped over one side, I suppose. If they'd been, maybe there'd been a scrum and everyone was around there and it got lobbed out. You were right on the other side. Then you could have run sort of past them, but they would have been all the way over there. Yeah. It's not impossible.
Marcus, were you sporty at school? You must have been.
I was house captain.
Oh, God. You were obnoxious.
100 meter record holder.
That is terrible.
It's only because I was so much bigger than everyone else.
That was the other one I did once. Is, you know, you have to jump over a horse. You know, they're not a real horse.
In the gym.
We couldn't afford
any of that.
We couldn't afford proper equipment, so we had to jump over a real horse because obviously you have a lot of those wandering around in Dorset. So I ran towards this horse to jump over it, and there's a little trampoline-y bit you have in front of it. I hit the trampoline, my foot went through the corner of the trampoline, and I whacked headlong into the end of the horse and headbutted it. My PE teacher actually laughed out loud. And he came up to me afterwards and apologised and said that it was massively unprofessional. Because, of course, the entire class just disintegrated into laughter.
Yeah, after Paul Berg's broken his neck again.
Yeah. I hospitalised somebody once as well.
Excellent. Well, we had, talking about those, it's like a vaulting horse, isn't it, the thing you're talking about?
Yeah.
We had one lad go over there, tried to jump. You're supposed to kind of like, I don't know, hop on your hands on the top of it. And he missed and went down the other side. And he landed on his knee on the floor. And the kneecap had gone out almost 90 degrees to the side of his leg. And it was like, whoa, dear, that's a bit rough.
Yeah, nice.
But yeah.
I will put a link in the show notes. But I don't know whether you know, whether I mentioned this before. But when I was at school back in the 1920s. Early 80s, I suppose. They came and filmed a TV documentary series about my school. It was called Kingswood. And they'd already done one a couple of years before about this posh, knobby private school somewhere down south, Dorset or somewhere. And then they came and did one, you know, a proper comprehensive school in the Midlands. And they filmed this thing. It took about 2 years. And by the time that they'd finished it, I was actually in the sixth form. And they did this sort of, I don't know, discussion program at the end of the series, a very kind of typical BBC program presented by Ludovic Kennedy, with, you know, various heads of education and the headmaster and knobby people and me. So I was on, that was my thing, you know.
It's so funny.
With the tie and everything. And actually, I got an email from an old friend of mine who I was actually at school with, and she sent me a link to, somebody's put all these things on YouTube.
That's what I'm looking for.
So I will find this link and I'll put it in the show notes. If anybody wants to see what a complete and utter pillock I look like in about 1982.
Yeah. Yeah. And he really does look like a complete and utter pillock. It did amuse me. Not quite as much as Marcus in Hands to Heaven's days.
Oh,
but
yeah, that was fantastic.
It was borderline that. So, Sam, I'm going to guess that you weren't very sporty at school.
I was very sporty.
Were you really?
I was, yeah. I was Mr. Football, hockey, whatever you name it. And actually, I was playing like sports from a really early age, like the weekends and at school. And then it was only because of that that I got into this industry. I basically tore my cruciate ligament twice, which meant I really couldn't play anymore. So I kind of thought I'd go into the other room and see what that box is. And here I am today.
Oh dear, so you could have been like a professional football player or something if it wasn't for your injuries.
Well, yeah, let's go with that. I could have been professional.
It would have been one of the backs for the England rugby team, I reckon.
You reckon?
Yeah, super
He's
fast.
He's got that look about him. Yeah.
Thanks.
And Drew, you're borderline. I can't work out whether I would say you were sporty or not. You are now, I know. But
I was about the least sporty personally. I would go and hide in the music room instead of to do it before. That was me. But once I was off school one day in fourth year, and my form had to submit a team for the cross country championship. And so because I wasn't there for a laugh, they thought they'd sign me up as team captain.
Oh no.
So I got back to school the next day and found out that I was running it that day as team captain. Anyway, we only bloody won.
Yes. Hey. In their face.
I showed them.
Yeah. So there you go. Now, I had this whole section at the beginning of the show where we were going to talk about future tech, but instead we've talked about
passport.
Which is, I think, just as interesting, really. And we've made up for it by having a lovely link in the show notes to Andy looking like a pillock, which is always good. What I want to know, Andy, is how did you get yourself selected? Were you one of the, did you have some society that you ran for kind of rebels without a clue or something like that? He's gone. He's wandered off. That or he's forgotten his mic is muted.
Or the liquid has got really out of hand now.
Yeah.
No. What, you mean to get on the telly?
Yeah, because, I mean, why, out of a whole school, how did you get picked as the honoured child to represent the entire school on BBC TV?
Well, I was actually head of the sixth form at this point. We had like a school council, and I was the head of the sixth form, so, yes.
Were you, did
head
you...
boy?
Not quite. No, we didn't have head boys or head girls. We had like a school council, which I like to think of as like a Soviet, you know, Politburo.
Yeah.
And
you had
people
done over that you didn't like.
Exactly. And I was Khrushchev.
I did get the distinct impression that you were like, you know, from seeing you on that video, that you were like campaigning for student rights and all that kind of crap. You were very PC and right on.
Yeah, I was.
Yeah.
He still is. Come on. Andy Brexit Clark.
He's just opinionated. There's a difference.
It was very funny. I've just found the link and I am putting it into show notes right now.
Wonderful.
Glorious.
That's going to be so funny. Right. Okay. Let's then move on from that glorious start to the show. I do apologize, dear listener, for that we've done nothing for 13 minutes. Let's talk about our sponsor. And then it'll be 15 minutes without doing anything. Videoblox, who've been supporting this whole season and is very much appreciated. They're an affordable subscription-based stock media site where you basically get unlimited access to premium stock footage. They also have a sister site called Audioblox that offers unlimited access to premium stock audio, as you might expect. And it's a great, great value, really, if you're doing any kind of video or audio work. Instead of having to pay per download, which quickly gets quite expensive if you do, you know, any kind of regular video or any kind of regular audio. Instead, they've got a subscription model. So you pay one fee for the whole year and then you can download as much as you want And not only as much as you want, it's unrestricted use. You can use it in whatever way that you need to. So they've got a selection of over 115,000 videos and 130,000 audio files. And for the average subscriber, because you download so much, it works out as less than $1 per year, really, per download, that is, over the period of the year. So you pay one fee over the year and you download so much, it only ends up costing you about $1 per download. They've got some really good high-quality stuff that's brilliant to use. I've used a lot of their material myself. They've done a really nice a listener package for you, where you get a year's subscription of both video blocks and audio blocks for only $149. So that's a $100 discount off of their usual price tag for people that follow the show. You can find out more about them at videoblocks.com/BoagWorld2016. Even if you're not intending to buy, go check them out at that link, because then they'll want to sponsor us again, which is great, because then I get more money. And that is ultimately what this show is all about. So there we go. That is, I really, you know, I suppose if Andy, being right on and a unionist at heart, would probably argue that I need to share the revenue from this show with the rest of my guests. But no, I'll just replace you, Andy, if you're going to say that.
Not even a bit of licorice.
I'll buy you a bit of licorice, although licorice is the devil's work. So as far as I'm concerned, buying you licorice would be punishing you.
I think you're confusing the devil with the Dutch.
I don't get that joke. What can someone explain it to me?
Just the licorice.
Yeah, but why Dutch?
Well, it's Dutch, isn't it?
No,
I is don't. It? How would anybody know that? I mean, if we were talking about Lego, maybe, but
that's not Dutch.
Lego's not Dutch.
I knew that. Where's Lego from then?
Denmark.
Further round.
See, Marcus didn't know either.
Yeah, over there. Scandinavia. Right,
we're calling this new segment of the show, Show Your Ignorance. What would you like to show your ignorance about? Seriously, I had no idea licorice was a Dutch thing. Is it like...
Me neither. You know,
I could be wrong. I could be completely wrong. I had it in my head that it was.
That's great. That's brilliant. I love it. Let's just... Well, I mean, we do the rest of the show on sweeping assumptions and generalizations, so why not that bit? Talking of sweeping generalizations and assumptions, let's do our discussion bit. Marcus, I think it'd be really good for you to kick off, considering you had that wonderful teaser at the start of the show.
Yes. So, I left everyone hanging, didn't I?
You did. The tension has been killing me ever since. So do you want to share a little bit what you want to talk about today?
Yes. And this is probably at the forefront of every agency owner's mind all of the time, every day. And it's the fact that if you do project work, which most agencies do, you don't develop a product and sell the product. I'll come on to that in a minute. But if you're doing project, not product, work for client A and then client B, and then the two will overlap, and then you're looking for client C, there's always a point, probably about two, three or four months into the future, depending on the size of the agency, when you haven't got any work. Because obviously you can't take on, well, you could take on work for in a year's time, but nobody ever comes in and says, I'd like you to do a project in a year. They expect you to be able to start within a month or so. So you've always got this kind of like, we can do so much work and that work will last until 2-3 months in the future. And then what? Mm. And there's always this concern that suddenly all the work's going to run out. And that kind of did happen to us in 2014. I mean, not completely. But we had a couple of projects that we expected to win. That we didn't, and it made it into a really rather unpleasant time of it. But that's not what I wanted to talk about today. What I want to talk about today is what could we possibly do to try and avoid that? I mentioned the development of products, which is something Headscape tried to do five, 6 years ago. And we've talked on the show about that in the past, about why that didn't work specifically for us. I think it's because our hearts weren't really in it and we took too long to do it. But it is a possible way that an agency can go, and that didn't work for us. I'm just wondering, does anybody else who in the agency world that you guys know who've developed products actually made any kind of serious income from it? Because obviously I know there are software developers maybe on points to Basecamp and things like that where they've made a fortune. But if you're going to put the effort into another stream of revenue, it's got to make you quite a lot of money. Otherwise, it's not worth putting the effort in. So I just wondered if anybody's got any kind of stories of other people that who've made this decision, right, we're going to develop a product and then kind of put a lot of effort in, and they've successfully been making a great deal from it ever since. Because well done them.
Well, I guess Drew and Rachel would be an example of that, because they used to do client work before Perch.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's exactly what we did. And we were a web development agency, and we were basically working with design agencies, sort of partnering up with them, doing the sort of techie side of their projects.
Right.
And we launched Perch as a side project that, like, literally we spent about 6 days, 3 weekends working on, and then just launched, thinking, this might be interesting. And what happened with that was it grew fairly steadily but reliably over the course of about 2 years, to the fact that it became then about sort of equal with our agency revenue.
Right.
So we kind of had to make a decision at that point. It was probably the most difficult point in terms of the sort of transition, was when we were 50% client work and 50% product work, because what we found that we hadn't anticipated so much is that the sort of requirements in terms of like communications and that sort of thing between those two different worlds is quite different. Mm. When you're working on projects for clients, you tend to, you know, have kickoff meetings and plan out the work, and then you sort of you don't go away and stop communicating, but you go away and start doing the work and then start feeding back and in quite a structured way usually.
Yeah.
But with a product where you've got customers and you then suddenly might have thousands of customers rather than half a dozen clients, you're getting requests coming in all the time. There might be pre-sales questions. There might be technical support questions. There might be things that you suddenly need to pay attention to because you've got a live product with, you know, payments coming in every day. Perhaps you've need to tweak something about your payment integration that has to be dealt with. So the demands we found with the product are quite sort of real-time demands. They're unpredictable and they're coming in all the time. And that really conflicted with our client project work. Mm. Because it's almost impossible. When we were at that point, we were sort of 50-50. It was almost impossible to say, right, today I'm going to work on this. Mm. Because there'd just be a constant stream of other things coming in that had to be attended to. And we found that we kind of needed to decide either we step back from the product or we step back from the project work. We can't have the same people doing the same things. Or I guess we try and step up, you know, bring in other people to do some of the project work. And it kind of got to that crucial point of just these two things conflicting, you know, as work that, that any individual needs to deal with.
I remember hearing, I think it was Jim Koodle. He might have been on this show actually many years ago, saying that, it was kind of one of the best days of his life when he realised that more than 50% of the revenue was from the products that they'd created rather than the client work that they were doing. And to him, it was like, well, that's the green light. All systems go. We go down this route. I mean, was that the same for you, Drew?
I guess it was. And part of that was personal, that we'd been doing client work for quite a long time at that point. And with our the way our business was, because we were doing this thing partnering with design agencies, it was a kind of an old-fashioned model of somebody else outside our company would do some design work and send us Photoshop files, and then we'd turn that into a website. And we were kind of becoming aware that that model of working just wasn't viable for getting the best results for a web project. It needed to be more collaborative. And so we were kind of at the point of realizing, we need to change something about how our business functions. And that was at the same point as then reaching this 50-50 tipping point with with product income. So for us, it was kind of an easy decision. It's like, let's focus on the product stuff.
I mean, it kind of depends on what your question is, Marcus. You know, because essentially what Drew and Rachel did and what Jim Koodle did is they moved away from an agency model entirely towards a product-based business. So in a sense, they didn't do what you originally said. They didn't push that cliff back any. They just changed the rules of the game.
Yeah, and I think my question on regarding product development, I guess, is can you do both? Can you? And I think from what Drew was saying is you can't. It doesn't work. I guess if you were a 50-person agency and you could develop, you know, you dedicate 20 people to agency work, 30 people to product work, maybe then. But I suspect even then it would probably cause frictions. I'm not sure. But there was another aspect to trying to avoid the cliff is the idea of charging clients ongoing for support and maintenance and that kind of thing. I've always thought that the model of charging clients X percentage of the value of a project going on for support, that and if you don't use it up within a certain amount of time, it just gets written off. I've always thought that was rather unfair to clients, and we don't do that. We kind of obviously we provide support for our clients that want it, but they basically buy a time bank of credits that don't ever run out. Just when they run out, you can have some more, kind of thing. But I'm just wondering, actually, my question here is, are we being too soft? And actually, the kind of the more traditional software company type support arrangement is actually really part of ensuring that you don't fall off the cliff, and means that you will remain around for your clients, that you won't suddenly kind of go out of business, and that I'm getting it wrong, possibly on the kind of nicer view towards support.
I have a time bank approach that I use, and yes, they do expire after a year or whatever period you set. I think that's acceptable, because I think what it also does is it motivates the client to keep developing, to keep moving forward, you know, which is what they should be doing anyway. I mean, Sam, you've worked with a lot of different situations and clients. You must have come across these kind of support arrangements.
Well, I mean, yes, support arrangements, we've had them, but as you say, they don't last long. They don't really tend to pull in much money, in my experience. I think rather than the product approach, the one I've seen work relatively well, especially if you focus on it, is you actually go down a very specific account management route. So yes, you're still doing your projects, but we used to see them as our way to begin a new relationship rather than just a project. And all the while that we're working on that project, we're looking for ways that perhaps we can be useful to them in that area, maybe not in that area. As you know, when you work for a small agency, work with companies, you have to live their company. You get to find all aspects, and it's amazing what sort of opportunities you can find. But that was always the way that seemed, the path of least resistance to getting that kind of regular revenue and filling those gaps up over the months.
So how would that work, in the sense that are you talking about that they pay you a fixed retainer and you just use as many of those hours as you can within the retainer? What's the business model
I think that's where you want to end up, ideally, maybe even a longer sort of fixed term kind of contract. But what would typically bridge between the sort of one-off project and the account management would be that kind of changing the client's perception of you from someone that delivers a thing to someone that delivers a service.
Yeah.
Even though that's what we say we do all the time, I think we get into the mindset. Plus, we've also got to have the right people. You talk about when do you know when to stop and focus on a product? It's the same kind of thing with recruitment. When do you start having a dedicated account manager? And these are the experts who can really leverage that client. But when, you know, so you typically find a project manager or maybe even the CEO or someone like yourself, Marcus, doing that job. But when you focus on that as a strategy without it being a sneaky strategy, let's say, it kind of pays off from time to time. I can't say we ever got to the point where, you know, we were filling up a year ahead, but we definitely saw some of those gaps filling up in the future because we knew this company was there.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, there's two points there. Existing clients, even if it's a kind of a big project for a brand new client, there's bound to be more stuff going to happen in the future. And you will be talking about that while you're doing the first project. So, yes, we can kind of allow for that going forward. But that's not the same as being on a retainer. No. And that's a bit of a kind of dream place, I think, for most agencies.
I don't think Marcus, you know, having a bit of an inside view of Headscape, I don't think Headscape has been aggressive enough in going after those retainers, because I actually think retainers, if they're done right, are a good deal for the clients as well, because I think, you know, a good retainer basically says, you know, we believe that you should be continually improving and adapting and making your website better rather than going through this boom bust cycle of redesign. And we've talked about that loads of times on the show. And it's the way, you know, continual iteration and improvement is the way that any website of any significant size should be designed. So that doesn't lend itself to a fixed price, fixed project model particularly well, because it relies on, you know, every new project feels like a new cost, feels like, you know, a new outgoing. And so as a result, they don't tend to happen. A retainer model, on the other hand, where you say, okay, we're going to pay this agency X amount, and, you know, they are going to continually develop. They're going to be doing user testing. They're going to be doing iterations. They're going to be providing us with reports and feedback showing the progress they've made. They're going to be working hand in hand with an internal contact within the organization. Not only then does that, you know, encourage that continual iteration, it's good from their business point of view, because they can now budget. You're going from a capital expense where, you know, every project is a new and unexpected expense to a continual investment, which is very predictable and very knowable. I don't think Headscape has pushed that heavily enough. I mean, that's the route that I've gone down with some of my clients. And it's worked very well that they pay a flat fee per month, and I'm always there to support them. I'm always there to help them. You know, so you would have to structure it in a slightly different way, but I actually think it's a very beneficial approach that's underutilized in the industry.
Yeah, I think there's two responses. One is that I agree that maybe that's something, certainly with some clients I can think of who we no longer work with, that might have worked with. I also think that it's something a lot easier said than done. And some clients just aren't interested in that. They want you to be there for them, but they would not. It's like trying to get some certain clients to pay for something on time and materials. It's like, no, we can't do that. It's, you know, we will only work on fixed price basis, and some would never work on a kind of like time bank basis rather than a retainer.
Yeah. And that's fine. I've got no problem with that if they don't want to work in that way. But I think, often, and I say this also about, often we self-censor ourselves in those kind of situations that we go, oh, they'll never go for it. And so we don't talk to them about it. We don't give them that option. And I think that can be a mistake that I see quite a lot, that, you know, if you don't ask, you don't get. And I think putting it in front of the client, outlining the benefits, outlining alongside that alternative approaches like time banks or whatever else, and let them decide. You know, is instead of saying to ourselves, oh, we'll never get it past that client, you know, or that they won't like it, or they won't think that way. I say exactly the same about in-house teams. I see it all the time in in-house teams, that an in-house team knows, you know, some great thing that they want to do, but they go, oh, my boss will never agree to it. And so they never ask them. Mm-hmm. So I say, if you don't ask, you don't get, personally.
I think it's what it comes down to is you've got to, if there's a client where you can see a great deal of value in you being part of their relationship going forward, then it's worth going for. If the amount of value you could bring would be quite little from, you know, month to month to month, then you're probably not worth bothering having the conversation. But if there is a definite, you can bring value to this client going forward, then it's worth having the conversation.
I mean, I would argue, just judging by the kind of clients that Headscape works with, you know, universities, large charities, you know, etc., that actually I would have thought that would apply to pretty much all of them.
Well, I'm only thinking of one where we had a client where we did kind of have this kind of ongoing strategic relationship, and actually we were maybe charging sort of double the amount that that they could actually spend of any value.
And I know the client you're talking about, and I think the problem there, and this is the key, I think, to a retainer being a value, is that in that you were relatively passive. You know, I was there at the time. So we would wait for the client to come to us with things that needed doing.
Not on that one. That's why I brought it up.
Oh, okay.
We were paid basically to kind of, we were making recommendations. We were measuring whether they were being successful or not. And basically there wasn't enough for us to do for the amount we charged.
Okay, well, in which case, then you charge too much, rather than the model being wrong,
We should have just basically charged for half the amount of time, and then it would have been bang on. It was just I just brought it up as an example of the one time when we really did kind of have a chat with a client about it, and they're like, yeah, we didn't get it right, but hey-ho, these things happen.
Andy, you've been very quiet.
No, I've been... this is one of the things that I seriously need to figure out how to fix in our business, because we are suffering and have suffered from exactly this for about the last 18 months, I suppose. I mean, it's been a bloody awful year financially for us this year. We've done some really nice work, but the pipeline had literally... I mean, it did fall off a cliff. I mean, there's no doubt about that. And I think the reason for that was sort of last summer we decided that I was going to rewrite Hardboiled, because we were so desperate to get out of our bloody publishing contract. The way to do it was to write a second edition. So we thought, right, how long is that going to take? It's going to take 6 weeks to basically, you know, do the amends and the bits and pieces. So we could easily sort of fit 6 weeks into that kind of quiet July, August period that we normally get. And anyway, sod's law was that it was much, much, much bigger job than I'd anticipated it being, and it ended up taking over 3 months. And I can't write and do work at the same time, so it was pretty much solid, and I didn't do any work and I didn't do any sales, most importantly, for those months. So by the time that we actually finished the book, kind of, I don't know, and got it out there late November, we had absolutely bugger all to do, because that sort of 3 month sales cycle, I hadn't been taken care of. You know, there was nothing
scary, isn't it?
Lined up. It was very, very scary. So we knew that there might be a couple of things happening. You know, they were kind of more or less confirmed for the new year, which is why we essentially said, you know, we'll take December last year off and, you know, I'll paint my kitchen. And do some other sort of business related stuff. But then when it came to the start of this year, fortunately, a few things started to kind of trickle in, but we have really suffered from me not paying attention to that sales cycle for 3 months. And it kind of got me wondering about how we could make money that wasn't dependent on the time that we spend sitting in front of computers. And I think that's the holy grail.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily think that is. I think that is a bit of a kind of fool's gold. You know, there are some elements. There are, you know, selling a product products is obviously one way of doing it. But what I'm more interested in, you know, that saying, we want a continual revenue stream that is going to come without direct intervention on our part of spending time in front of a computer. But the truth is, even if you have a product, as Drew and Rachel will testify, you know, you still got to sit in front of that computer. You've still got support calls. You've got all of those other things to do. So for me, getting away from that cliff and that kind of edge is about being able to fill up the pipeline further ahead. So for me, it's about things like the way that I've done it is these retainer arrangements where, you know, every 3 months or every month or however you choose to structure it, you know, I've got money coming in there because I know that that's going to happen. I know that they're going to, because they've signed up for a year. I have arrangements where I do training that I do pretty much every month. So I know that there's going to be a bit of money coming in from that every month. speaking, I find works well, because that's always further ahead. People plan further ahead when it comes to conferences and speaking arrangements. So it's about identifying the type of work that either happens on an ongoing basis, come what may, like training, like retainer arrangements, like that kind of stuff, or stuff that is planned further ahead. That would be my perspective on it.
Well, but I
can see a couple of hands up. So
we're going to do a couple of things. We've been working over the last couple of months with a business consultant, Chris Thurlow, who has been helping me kind of figure out a strategy for moving forward, because being continually hungry for new business is incredibly tiring. And what we are trying to look at, and you know, your suggestions are gold, is moving away from working on just a project to thinking about things more in terms of an account. You know how, you know, an old advertising agency days, you know, I suppose it still happens, you know, they'll win a big account and they'll work with a client or have a contract for X number of years or whatever to do whatever ad agencies do. Well, we can't really do that on the web. People often say, you know, do you have a maintenance contract? And to me, you know, unless you're patching WordPress plugins, websites don't need oil. So that the idea of a maintenance contract has never really sat well with me. But the idea that we can do some form of kind of ongoing consulting or mentorship, or particularly now that I'm doing a lot more work with in-house teams, that's the kind of thing where I'm looking to say, sign up with a client and say, yeah, okay, we're going to charge you X amount for doing the job with you now, but then a certain amount going forward. Which is not necessarily tied to a deliverable, but it's much more about improvement and expertise and that kind of thing. And we're going to do that alongside making some stuff to sell because we fancy doing it.
Yeah, and that's fine. If you fancy doing it, then, you know, by all means, go ahead and do it. But I do exactly the same as you, Andy. You know, I work with clients over the long term where I'm consulting with them and really digging into their business and spending time with it. And it works. I'm looking at my pipeline now and I haven't filled up months entirely, you know. So for example, January is always a bit kind of crappy. So I'm $2,000-$3,000 off of my target for that month. But then, you know, February, March, all the way through to May isn't looking too bad at the moment. And I've got stuff going right the way through till, you know, August next year.
Yeah. See, we don't.
So that's a,
you know, we don't have that. I mean, that's, it's one of the things sort of misperceptions, I suppose, that people have about, you know, me or our business or the work that we do or whatever. But no, we don't have that pipeline. I'm looking at an empty calendar from the end of January onwards. Now, you know, stuff always lands. We haven't marketed ourselves for 18 years, but, you know, stuff always kind of falls through the door. But you can't rely on that in today's market. And it is stressful and tiring to be so hungry all the time. So that's why, you know, it's why we're working with Chris, and it's why we have to try to move away from this whole kind of falling off a cliff model.
There's like hundreds of hands up in the room. Drew, can I come to you next? Because I did mention about the earlier about, that if you move to a product, it doesn't mean you can sit back and relax. I imagine it's something along those lines you've got to say, is it?
Yeah, I guess I was thinking that actually maybe there are types of products where you can sit back and relax, certainly a lot more than we tend to think of the type of products like, okay, we're doing agency work, let's also launch a web app that does something that's maybe complementary to what we do. But then there's also the sort of more passive income type things like writing a book. Rachel does CSS grid training courses. You can just go and sign up on our site and get videos and everything and learn all about CSS grid. Now, obviously, that was a lot of work to put that together initially, but now that sits there and there isn't really any day-to-day involvement for her to need to be able to do that. And, you know, people come along and buy it. So I guess that, you know, writing books or even just like little ebooks or small things that maybe you can encapsulate some of what you know as a business and share that in some way with, your contemporaries in a more sort of passive income type product than something that is actually a distraction from your core business. I think that sort of is another interesting aspect to think about.
Yeah, I mean, I've done that. Certainly, I obviously make a bit of money out of books. I've got video courses that I do. I mean, something, Andy, that I could imagine you doing is some of this, producing design assets, reusable design assets that people can help themselves do as well. That's a passive income, I guess. But whether you'd want to get into that side of things, I'm not so sure whether it's you.
Well, no, funnily enough, it is something that I am working on right now. In fact, week and next week. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail in terms of exactly what it is, but we've been doing a lot of work in the kind of pattern library, design systems, style guide sphere for a long time. And I'm very, very disappointed with the way in which most people present that stuff. So we're actually working on something which hopefully brings a little bit more creativity to that area. We've got a couple of weeks before we start a new client project. So actually let's spend it making something that we can sell later on. So I don't object to that at all. It's about time I bloody capitalized on some of this, infamy, I suppose. All of these years that I've been going out there doing conference talks for other people, I've never been that sort of person that speaks about something that then I back up with training or consulting or whatever. I'm not like, for example, Luke Rablewski or you, there's a very direct kind of link between the thing that I talk about on stage and then, oh, we'll hire him to do this. I spoke about comic book design for 2 years, nobody it doesn't translate into money whatsoever. So I suppose in hindsight, I could have been a little bit more businesslike about that. And that's the thing that's changing now.
And that's the thing, I think you hit the nail on the head there, is that, and you said it as well earlier, that marketing, continually marketing yourself, continually selling is absolutely essential in our work. Whether it be doing podcasts like this where I hope that afterwards somebody might give me a ring and say, hey, you said this on the show, I'd like to follow that up with you, or me mentorshipping agencies would tie in perfectly with today. And you can find out more about that but you get the idea. So relating your products and services directly to the stuff that you're putting out into the world is really, really important as well. Sam?
Yeah, it's just one last thing, really. Having come from sort of through small, medium, and seen all sorts of agency sizes, I can really, really testify to the fact that the temptation and the money says that the people who are selling or running the business should be the ones to try and forge these accounts that we were talking about to begin with. But every time I've seen that attempted, it tends to not go too well. I think mainly because of time, and the people aren't experts at that skill. And all I will say is, when I've gone from environments where there was no sort of dedicated account management function, but even if it's one person whose job is that, and then I've gone to it where they have it, the difference is really noticeable. A lot of project managers or biz dev people think they're fantastic at handling clients, but there's a different something about that account management with that strategic vision in mind. And also they can really help to sort of just very subtly change the people that are working at your business to think a bit more like that. It's a very subtle movement, but when I've gone from without to with, it just seemed like, what I'm saying, I guess, is if you can afford it, I think you should think about hiring someone to try and do this rather than do it all of yourself.
Now, is there a kind of size? I could imagine an agency of, Headscape size or up needing dedicated account managers. But, with people like Andy and Andy's business,
that's the tricky thing. That's the tricky thing. I mean, whether you can get someone maybe not as experienced to do it, I don't know, but I mean this is why I don't run a business. Exactly for this reason,
because I've got to say, personally, I think there's a huge benefit when the business owner is the person liaising and working with the clients. I accept what you're saying about, it's not a straight sales role. Marcus, I think I would describe you more as an account manager than a salesman.
Yeah. I mean, if we're viewing a salesman who's somebody who kind of bangs the phone and chases after, you know, RFPs and that kind of thing, then no, that's not me. Basically, because I think for the kind of value of work we're looking for, you're not going to be very successful if you try to be a kind of straight salesman like that. So the vast majority of the work that we've won over the years has been because we've worked with our existing clients, we've done a good job. They've therefore hired us to do more work. They've spoken to other people, you know, their friends that are in other organizations that are similar. So it's kind of very much my job to ensure that happens, basically. And yes, that is an account manager role, if you like. But I strongly believe that it should be the owners of a business that are doing that job. Certainly in a small agency like us. That's one of the reasons why I don't think we managed to kind of successfully grow past 20 people. As I've said many times, we're now back down to 10 people. But when you get to sort of 20, and I imagine when you get to 30 people and 40 people, you need to kind of trust other people to do that job for you. And that's something that I was always uncomfortable with. I've always said that I think it's the owner's job to bring the work in. And I think the best way to do that, as I've just said, is to kind of work with existing clients, and just try and get your reputation out there, further and further afield.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really interesting subject, this whole idea of pushing out that kind of fall off, where, you know, and the makeups of what it is that your agency does. We've actually spent the whole show talking about this one thing, and I'm happy with that because I think it's really good. I mean, the things that, just to kind of summarize what's been said in my mind, that, you know, if you want to push past that kind of 3-month barrier, is you have to be marketing and promoting yourself on a continual basis. So not allowing that kind of boom bust of, oh, it's gone quiet, let's panic and do a load of marketing stuff. And then when you get busy, you drop it. You cannot allow that to happen. I think products are a really interesting way, but I totally agree with Drew's comments about, you know, maybe focus more on products that are passive, you know, passive income stuff, unless you want to move away from project work entirely, like Drew and Rachel have done, and that's a different ball game entirely. I think Andy is entirely right as well about pursuing more consultative relationships with clients, because I think that naturally leads itself more to ongoing work. I think looking for those retainer based arrangements where you proactively manage the relationship with the client is another really good opportunities. So actually, there's some really cool stuff in here, and I think it is possible. Well, I know it's possible to build a business which kind of, it doesn't have that drop off point, or at least not so dramatically. So there we go. That is pretty much it, I think, for this show. That was actually a really good discussion. I think a lot of people find that very useful. Now we've got our second sponsor, which is Vivaldi, joining us this week. Vivaldi is a browser that you may or may not have heard of. I thought I'd do something a little bit different with this. So instead of having me telling you a little bit about Vivaldi, what I've done is asked them to say a little bit about Vivaldi and what they think makes it a different kind of app. So we're going to just play a little bit of audio from the guys here telling you a little bit about Vivaldi.
Hey everyone, it's Molly here from Developer Relations at Vivaldi Browser, Vivaldi.com. You might remember me from the bad old days of the web browser wars, the Web Standards Project, and maybe you might have read a book or two. I've spent my career advocating for a free and open web that puts people first, whether it be through the user experience, accessibility, and most passionately and notably, to ensure that browsers implement the things we want and need. I also spent many years as an invited expert to the W3C, especially in the CSS working group. This is why I cannot imagine being anywhere else than here at Vivaldi Browser, and here's why. Our interface is being built using HTML, CSS, SVG, JavaScript, and open web technologies, making it super easy for any of us with these common core skills to turn it into a powerful driver of our websites, our applications, and even extended technologies as we move forward into the Internet of Things and a brave new world. Here's the important message, though. We're here for you. We are you. We are a small group of passionate people with the leadership and resources to make something awesome and lasting for and with this industry, to embrace the best practices of inclusive design and user-first ideologies. So please download our recent 1.5 release at Vivaldi.com and let us all know how we can grow better together.
Okay, so that's Vivaldi. You can find out more about them at boag.world/betterbrowser. Wonderful. Right, so that is it. Really interesting discussion. Only covered one topic, but wow, that was one hell of a topic and really interesting discussion. So thank you for that, Marcus. Let's go quickly round table and find out where people can discover more about our panel today. Drew, where can people find out more about you?
On Twitter, I am at Drew M. And on the web, you can find me at 24ways.org, especially during December.
Yeah, we've got December coming up, haven't we? So not long. If you don't know about 24 Ways, it's an advent calendar of articles that makes you look smarter. Something along those lines, isn't it?
That's exactly it, Paul. Yes, those are the exact words.
It's not far off of it. I know there's something about smarter and an advent calendar.
The full title is 24 Ways to Impress Your Friends.
That's it.
It's daily, I don't even know, web design and development articles.
Yeah. And of course, because Drew only has to come up with 24 of them for the whole year, they tend to be of really high quality and they're really, really interesting stuff. So definitely subscribe to that. Okay, Andy, where can people find out more about you?
People can find out more about me and they can hire me as a brilliant designer and consultant and everything else at stuffandnonsense.co.uk, or you can send me a tweet. My DMs are open at Malarkey.
Ooh. So yes, Andy's not shy at blowing his own trumpet, but I will do it for him as well. If you need design services or design consultancy, he is absolutely the dog's bollocks, as the phrase goes. Talking about the dog's bollocks and people that provide incredible design services, there's Marcus. Where can people find out more about you and Headscape?
Headscape.co.uk. And yes, you can hire us as well. Although we're kind of like quite busy right at the moment. Book us up for in about 6 months' time. Is that okay? Can I say that?
Yeah. Yeah. Schedule yourself in. It's fine. It does raise another interesting issue, which is part of this whole 3 month cliff thing, is because clients don't plan far enough ahead, and digital in particular is really reactive in a lot of businesses, which worries the shit out of me. But anyway, there's a whole nother conversation in that. Sam, where can people find out about you? You don't need hiring, do you?
No. If you want any Percy Pigs, I'm your man. That's about it. You can get me on Twitter at the Sam Barnes, and the website is thesambarnes.com.
And it's worth checking out Sam's website, especially if you ever have to manage any kind of projects. He writes great articles about various aspects of project management. So definitely subscribe there as well. Also, Sam, didn't you have a couple of things you wanted to push this week?
So a couple of conferences that I'm involved in the project management, digital project management area. So the first one is called DeliverConf. That's going to be in Manchester at the end of January next year. And you can get that at deliverconf.co.uk. And the other one is called Ground Control, and that's going to be in April next year in London. And you can get more details on that at 2017.groundcontrolconf.com.
And again, if you work in any kind of digital project manager role or oversee projects, these conferences are great. Yeah. They're such a good place to just have a good moan about everything that's difficult.
I think what's different about these two, particularly on the DPM Summit in the US, is that I think it's now transitioning from, so it was very much digital project managers and management. Now it's just anyone that delivers work, you know, product, whatever it is. So it's quite a nice work. It's a natural kind of evolution, I think, to that. So.
Absolutely. I was supposed to be speaking at DeliverConf, but unfortunately I'm not going to be able to now, and I'm absolutely gutted. I really am.
You're not on the site anymore, I've checked, so they're done with you. That's it.
It's so sad. But it's an excellent conference. Definitely go. As you could tell, I'm not happy. Anyway, we've spent far too much time bigging up other people's stuff. So let's get on to the important content before we wrap up, which is Marcus's joke, which he has prepared weeks in advance and hasn't just been looking it up right now.
It's true. I suddenly had a moment of panic earlier that I didn't have a joke. This is not the first time this has ever happened on this show, but it looks like Mr. Clark has a joke, so I'm going to defer to him.
Oh, I missed that.
Well, in the I'm feeling miserable because I'm sitting here under grey skies when Brexit, in the spirit of continuing my Australian obsession,
mm-hmm.
What kind of music do kangaroos like?
I know I'm not going to like the answer to this. Go on.
Hip-hop.
That's to my level. Thank you.
No.
There was a chorus of silence there.
I really tried.
Now you know how it feels.
I considered playing the laughter soundtrack clip thing, but it didn't even deserve that, Andy.
No, I know. It was fairly tawdry, that joke, to be honest.
That is disappointing. All right. Well, thank you very much, guys, for tuning in for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it. I would really be interested to hear people's comments on this one, because I think it is such an interesting area that anybody who runs or is part of an external agency face the whole time. So go along to boagworld.com. Let's see if I can work out what the URL is. Hang on just a second. See, this is where I should plan it in advance rather than just winging it, because I would really like people's comments. So if you go to boagworld.com, wow, my site's taking a long time to load at the moment.
While you're doing that, but basically I was just thinking that because we had a whole show on my subject that I don't have to do any more topics for the rest of the year.
Oh no.
Do I get the time?
No, it doesn't work like that. Oh. And do you know what? Do you want to know something really annoying? This flipping thing isn't loading. Here we go. Let's go with this. So it's boagworld.com/season/16. This is such a crap URL for an audio podcast. /episode/1607. You're going to remember that one, aren't you? So just go along to the website, look up season 16 and go to episode 7 and comment. I would really like to hear people's feedback over this particular issue. Do you have a 3-month cliff or even less? Have you found a way of overcoming it? Check out what other people have said. All right, thank you very much for listening and speak to you again in a week's time. Goodbye. Bye.